This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the American state kills whoever it wants, wherever it wants, at home and abroad. 500,000 Americans may find out they can't vote on Election Day. And is black radio on the way out? But first, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union have filed suit against officials of the CIA and the U.S. military in the drone killings of three American citizens in Yemen last year. Attorney Pardis Cabrei says the killings violate both the U.S. Constitution and international law.
We believe the U.S. has an obligation to answer for these killings and to explain their conduct. And, you know, this lawsuit is an effort to enforce that obligation. The specific strikes at issue were carried out on September 30th, targeting Anwar al-Awlaki, who had been put on government kill lists over a year before. That strike that targeted and killed him ended up killing others that it appears the U.S. was not targeting. One of those killed, along with Anwar, was Samir Khan, also an American citizen. And then 2 weeks later, the U.S. carried out another strike on October 14th of 2011 that killed a 16-year-old boy, also an American citizen. His name was Abdul Rahman, and he was Anwar al-Awlaki's son. And he was doing no more than sitting outside having dinner with his teenage cousin when U.S. missiles struck and killed him and six others. For Abdul Rahman's death, the United States has not only not explained its conduct, but it hasn't even acknowledged its role in that strike. It hasn't acknowledged the death at all. In Anwar al-Awlaki's case, the government has been very quick to come forward and claim responsibility for that strike and to praise it. But with respect to the October 14th strike that killed a 16-year-old, they've been absolutely silent.
You're suing certain CIA officials and military officials, but why not President Obama, who has put out the word very clearly that he is the sole arbiter of who lives and dies?
That's right. It is clear that President Obama sits at the top of this bureaucracy that's carrying out these killings in the executive branch. But in this particular suit for violations that have occurred after the fact, the president has immunity. So there are just legal reasons why we weren't able to name him as a defendant. We did, though, certainly name him as a defendant in our first case that CCR and the ACLU brought in 2010, which was challenging the reported authorization for Anwar al-Awlaki's killing when that was reported. So we did name President Obama then, and we have no qualms about naming him in general. But in this particular suit, we just weren't able to.
You speak of shifting legal standards and allegations never tested in court, allegations by the government. Are you looking for clarification of the standards that the U.S. government uses, or are you challenging their right to targeted killing?
We're challenging these particular deaths, but these deaths are connected to a broader program of targeted killing that is, in our view, has no legal basis or lawful legal basis. The government's position is that it's engaged in a war of global dimensions with al-Qaeda and undefined, unnamed associated forces, and that war exists not only in situations of active fighting and combat, such as, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan and what used to be going on in Iraq, but that it extends far beyond those battlefields. And that position is just not supported by international law. Under the laws of war, you can only use war-like force, armed conflict-type force, where you have situations of armed conflict. And those situations only exist where you have a certain intensity of fighting and you have a certain organization of groups on both sides. And factually, objectively, when these strikes occurred in September and October of 2011 in Yemen last year, our position is those conditions did not exist and that the law that should have governed the United States' actions in Yemen and certainly vis-a-vis its own citizens was the Constitution and international human rights law. And under that framework, there is a very strict definition or very strict standard of when the government can kill. It has to, under the Constitution, charge and try people whom it believes are engaged in wrongdoing, and if they are convicted of a capital crime in this country, they can be executed. Outside of that very uncontroversial standard, the U.S. can only use lethal force in circumstances of self-defense where you have an imminent threat and lethal force is a last resort. And that standard was not, in our view, complied with in these killings. So in terms of the vagueness, the U.S., it's vague in terms of exactly what criteria and how they're interpreting the law, but what is not apparently vague is that they are applying this sort of armed conflict, law of war paradigm to their killings in Yemen and in general outside of situations like Afghanistan.
If the U.S. government doesn't even bother to indict someone and try to capture them, it seems rather obvious that they are not about making an arrest.
I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, the U.S. has said some very strong things about Anwar al-Awlaki and why they were targeting him. But what it has said are statements. They're allegations. They are not things that have been supported by evidence that anyone in the public or any court has seen. They've not been tested. So I think if it's true that Anwar al-Awlaki was engaged in crimes and presented a threat, unless he presented an imminent threat under the Constitution, the U.S. was obliged to charge and try him. And again, if he had been convicted, then he could have been killed in this country. But the circumstances of this killing were outside of, in our view, a situation where Anwar presented an imminent threat, and he had never been charged for any crime. And I think it's important also to, you know, go back to the other two people who were part of this case, Samir Khan and 16-year-old Abdul Rahman, against whom not only had the government never brought charges, but had, with respect to the 16-year-old, never said anything about him, you know, even statements ever connecting him with al-Qaeda or terrorism or violence of any kind. So it certainly, with respect to those two individuals, has an obligation to explain its conduct.
If the government is so confident of its extraordinary powers, they should welcome this challenge in court.
Absolutely, and that's what we say. You know, we encourage the government to present any evidence it may have and to allow a court to resolve this dispute. And if it has evidence that these killings were lawful, it can and it should present that evidence in court.
That was Pardis Cabreyi of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hundreds of African Americans are killed by police without trial each year. Carl Dix, a founder of Stop, Stop and Frisk, was on hand for the last day of a family vigil for Romarley Graham, the unarmed black teenager gunned down in front of his family by police in the Bronx, New York.
This was a very significant case because the cops who stalked him to his house, broke into the apartment, and shot him dead, said that they suspected that he had a gun. So they wanted to check him for that. In other words, they wanted to stop and frisk him. After they murdered him, they were able to find no gun in the apartment. They gunned him down while his grandmother and his six-year-old brother watched in horror. Then they took the grandmother into custody, took her to the police station, and interrogated her for hours. And initially wouldn't even let her lawyer come in to see her, which would have interrupted their interrogation. This is how the police roll. And Mayor Bloomberg, Police Chief Kelly have the nerve, the unmitigated gall to talk about stop and frisk saving lives, when here's a very clear case where stop and frisk stole the life of an innocent young man. Even if it doesn't go to that level, it is still wrong, but in this case it went to that level of murdering an innocent young man. So this vigil and this case is very significant, and what makes it even more significant is when this cop was finally charged and brought into court to face charges for gunning down this unarmed young man, dozens of other NYPD cops came out to cheer him on, and there was an obscene sight of these dozens of cops cheering and calling this murdering cop the man. You the man, you the man. See, because a lot of times people tell us, well, it's only a handful, a few bad apples that do this on the police force. Well, most of the cops don't shoot anybody, but then when dozens of them come out and treat a murdering cop like he's a hero, it tells you that there is something wrong with the police force. And what that something wrong is that they are the enforcers of the inequality and oppression that the capitalist system brings down on people, especially down on black and Latino people. It's something that's been going on too long. It must be stopped. And frankly, right now, I am part of a bus tour, the Basics bus tour, that is taking Bob Avakian's voice and works through the streets of New York, connecting with people who are tired of being their neighborhoods being patrolled by cops who act like they're swaggering through an occupied country, treating them as people that they've defeated and occupied. People are tired of that. They want to know if there's any way to stop it. And what we're saying to them is that the kind of revolution that Bob Avakian has re-envisioned and represents is exactly the way to do that.
Ramarlee Graham is one of the statistics represented in a report put out by the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which shows 110 black people extrajudicially executed between January 1st and June 30th of this year.
Yes, and on that report, they have updated it because they discovered 10 more killings. So that's like 20 black people killed per month so far this year by the police. And people need to get that that's only the black people the police have killed. That doesn't count the Latinos, the Asians, or the white people. We know that it's mainly blacks and Latinos, but they do kill Asians and whites as well. So when you look at the once every 36 hours point that the Malcolm X grassroots movement makes in their report, you have to figure that there are many more killings to be added if we looked at the whole demographic and the various nationalities that the police kill. But then you need to look into the Malcolm X grassroots report and to add that to reports that have been done previously, because the Stolen Lives Project of the October 22nd Coalition has been working to document killings at the hands of the police. And what this project found was that most of the people killed by the police were unarmed. More than half of them were not even involved in activity that by any stretch of the imagination could be considered criminal. Yet still they were gunned down, beaten to death, or killed in other ways by the police. And the other thing that that report found, which also holds true for the Malcolm X grassroots movement report, is that in almost no cases did the cops even get charged for killing innocent, unarmed people.
It's hot on the streets of New York. There's a heat wave. What's the mood there as you tour in the Basics bus tour?
The mood is one of anger and a growing willingness to express that anger at the way the cops are treating people. Because when people heard that we were here talking about revolution and a different way the world could be, the first thing they wanted to go to was stop and frisk and the way that the police treat people. We're going out to people on the streets with ideas of how to step up resistance to stop and frisk and to the ways that the police treat us. And that's been pretty interesting, too, because I had three conversations with people in the Bronx who were like, I like this idea, because we're looking at a day in September where we hold vigils looking for the cops stopping and frisking people, focusing it up right after school hours, because that's when the cops do a lot of their brutality aimed especially at the young people, the kids coming out of school. People were like, I like this idea, but nobody else will. So I turned it around on them. I said, well, wait a minute. If you like the idea, then let's start collecting the handful of people who will go with this idea right now, and let's start organizing it. And I guarantee you that if we start doing that, we will get other people. And off of that, we've got it set up to get back with these people, get them together, and begin to develop the plan for doing this so that we can begin to spread it to others, so that by the time school opens up in September and we take this step, there will be many more people who want to do this, because I remember the tens of thousands of people who marched down Fifth Avenue on Father's Day. They marched under a theme of end stop and frisk. That's what they want. The mayor wants to mend stop and frisk. That's his borrowing from Jesse Jackson. Mend stop and frisk, don't end it. And he's trying to gather up black politicians and black ministers who will sit down and negotiate reforms to stop and frisk. You know, but you can't reform injustice. You have to get rid of it. You know, when the people in the 60s went up against Jim Crow segregation, they didn't say, give us a few more seats on the back of the bus or clean up the colored toilets a little bit. They said, get rid of Jim Crow. We have to take the same approach to the new Jim Crow, whether that's the racial profiling, the mass incarceration, or the open discrimination against people after they've served their sentence. We have to take an approach of all of this has got to be ended.
Carl Dix of Stop, Stop and Frisk in New York. The Brennan Center for Justice has released a report that claims a 500,000 Americans could face significant challenges when they try to vote in November due to a new photo ID law passed by 10 states. Keisha Gaskins is senior counsel to the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and she's a co-author of the report.
We took a look at the states that had imposed these highly restrictive voter ID laws. And we really had some questions about once the legislators and policymakers said, you know, we're going to make these IDs free, and so there won't be a problem. And we had a real question as to what it meant for people to access IDs and ID systems. And so we looked at not only transportation questions, but the ability to access ID and the whole scope of other challenges. And so one of the things that 500,000 number comes from is looking at eligible American voters who live more than 10 miles away from any ID issuing office and that live in households that lack access to a vehicle. And we thought this is going to be a very serious population that's going to be impacted. And so that was one of our top line numbers. Our evaluation of the situation doesn't stop there, but that's part of where that 500,000 number comes from, is really looking at eligible voters who live more than 10 miles away from an ID issuing office who lack access to a vehicle in their household.
And these states that are imposing these ID requirements, they're making these qualifications free in order to avoid being charged with placing an undue burden on poor people.
Exactly. More specifically, they're trying to avoid the poll tax, right? Certainly the court in its 2008 decision on the Indiana photo ID law said that the process of making the IDs themselves free is what allowed Indiana to avoid any charge of a poll tax in that state. Obviously, their law is different than the laws passed in the other states, and so there may be some legal questions that remain open. But at a minimum, the court was very clear that the ID itself had to be free.
But you're saying it still has a voter suppressive effect.
Certainly, because the ID itself being free doesn't actually eliminate the problems with people having to, one, obtain the ID itself if they do not already have it. And so these can run into problems with transportation, which is detailed in the report, problems with accessing underlying documentation that you need to obtain photo ID, and those problems really do range. So you've got the story of Selma Mitchell, I think a lot of people have already heard of. She's a woman out of Tennessee. And Ms. Mitchell was born in Alabama and did not have a birth certificate. She had to work with a volunteer attorney, get her husband's death certificate, her children's birth certificates, her school records, her children's school records, as well as a few other different forms of documentation, which cost her hundreds of dollars to be able to prove the very fact that she was born, even though she had a voter registration card, in order to access the systems in Tennessee. The fact is that it's not as simple as many people think, where it's just a matter of going down to the DMV and getting an ID if you have problems with transportation, if there are no ID issuing offices that are open nights or weekends, and someone works all day but doesn't have access to vacation time or cannot afford to take time off. Well, these are all like really real situations that people find themselves in, and these all pose problems to the ability to vote.
And you made a specific focus on the black belt in the South and the brown belt around the Mexican border.
Those were two areas, as we looked around the country, that we thought were really graphic examples of what the problems were. These were both areas where not only did we have high minority populations, there were in some cases also high poverty populations, but very low incidence of photo ID issuing offices. Public transportation was unavailable or marginally available in these areas. And we noticed that the offices that were present, many of them had very limited hours or didn't exist at all. There were big gaps in the counties in terms of being able to access these offices. So we really did notice that there really are some geographic implications to this problem as well.
And so you're finding that there is a lack of offices available in those same areas where we have a history of voter suppression of blacks and browns.
Yes, we did see some evidence of that.
And this, of course, in the past has been by design. And what about today?
Certainly in South Carolina and Texas, where we are litigating, we have certainly alleged that there was a discriminatory purpose in passing the voter ID laws in those states. Our report, we did not evaluate legislative history. We did not go back and actually look to see if we could find correlations between current activity and whether or not there was an intent to discriminate based on things like ID offices and access. What we did was we simply examined the reality of the situation, that regardless of the intent when the laws were passed, this is the impact and this is the effect, and that was where our concern really lay, was what is it going to mean to voters who have the right to access the polls but now find themselves, because of infrastructure problems, because of challenges with government bureaucracy, because of catch-22s where you need a photo ID to get a birth certificate, but you need a birth certificate to get a photo ID, and, you know, voter after voter that is caught in this sort of cycle. So in terms of, as an empirical matter, did we look to see if there was evidence of discrimination? No, we did not specifically do that. I think we can look at the history of the country and the history of these areas and really see kind of what we know as a historical fact. But at the end of the day, regardless of how you want to characterize the intentional law being passed, we know what the effect of the law is, and our report demonstrates a lot of those effects. The laws that are being passed are inappropriate. They are under-inclusive in terms of the numbers of IDs that are acceptable, and they are ineffective in terms of many of the stated objectives to eliminate any voter malfeasance or any problems at the poll. These laws really don't affect any problems there. So when you take sort of in total the rest of the research that we do and really looking at these cases, we really do not believe that these laws are necessary because they really don't accomplish any of the objectives as supported by the advocacy of laws while at the same time really harming Americans.
When most people think of voter suppression, they think of the Deep South, but your study takes a look at places like Indiana and Kansas and Pennsylvania.
Absolutely. I mean, these are all examples of locations where the laws have been passed. You can add Missouri and Wisconsin to that list. And Missouri and Wisconsin, in both of those cases, state courts stood up and said, look, these laws violate our state constitutions. There's a challenge in Pennsylvania under the Pennsylvania state constitution saying that these laws are violative. There is no correlation necessarily simply between these states being in the South. The fact is that these types of activities have real partisan ramifications, and unfortunately, we are seeing some elected officials really use poll access as a partisan tool. I think the most important thing to come out of this report is not just, you know, the statistical numbers, you know, 500,000 voters. Certainly we know that there is a statistical significance. When you look at Pennsylvania, for example, Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, the Secretary of State released a report based on Department of Transportation numbers that 750,000 Pennsylvania citizens are registered to vote but do not have a state identification card. Well, in a state where Obama won with 600,000 votes in 2008, you can see that there is a real statistical significance and a quantitative impact of these laws in a very real way. Beyond that, however, every data point represents an individual, represents a hardworking American citizen who's being denied their rights. And that's really what we really feel is very important to come out of this report, that we came out with a lot of numbers and a lot of maps and a lot of pictures, but at the end of the day, these all represent individuals. These all represent Americans who are being affected and potentially disenfranchised.
Keisha Gaskins of the Brennan Justice Center. A number of black organizations and media activists sent a letter to the Federal Communications Commission requesting an investigation into what they call the demise of black radio. Dr. Todd Burrows, a lecturer on communications at Morgan State University in Baltimore, is one of the signatories. We asked Dr. Burrows why he thinks black radio is dying.
I think radio is facing a very slow death. At least that's what my textbook says at Morgan State University. The issue is always when America catches a cold, black America catches pneumonia. And so with radio dying as a revenue stream, I think the money people are less patient for certain formats, and there's more of an emphasis of synergy. So it's not completely surprising that, you know, let's say Kiss FM would die in New York for an ESPN station. Like, that's not completely surprising. What's sad is that so much of African-American political and cultural advancement has depended on commercial media. And with the very slow demise or evolution of commercial media, we're going to get a huge hit in terms of our political and social and cultural and historical development in the future.
Well, black radio's fiscal demise, many believe, was preceded by the death of its functionality, its service to the black community itself.
Well, we do know that when the radio consultants stepped in the 70s, they made it very clear that radio was a money-making medium, and that every minute, every second was to be used and cataloged and characterized. So we knew the moment that came in, it was the end of the political and cultural development of the black community. But again, it was slow. It was a slow death. You know, to go back to the New York example, I mean, Kiss FM was not black radio in the way that WBLS and clearly WIB was black radio. But Kiss FM still had a function within black New York that black New Yorkers respected. So even though Kiss was the example of white corporate radio attempting to imitate black radio, it still functioned in many specific ways the way black radio functioned in the black community. So now, without a Kiss FM, and maybe without a WBLS, we're entering into this new era in which there will be no concessions to culture. There will be no concessions to political and social development. And that's going to be a new era.
The signatories are also concerned about black ownership of radio. But in the case of, for example, Radio One, which became the largest black-owned operator of black-oriented radio stations, we saw virtually no difference between their news programming and Clear Channel's news programming at its black-oriented affiliates, that policy being no news.
Well, Radio One has tried to have it both ways. They want to be a commercial, stockholder-dependent media company. And when they can, they fit in programming that they use to offset the programming they're not using. So, for instance, okay, Radio One does not have any news programming. That's true on all of its main FM channels. However, they do have AM stations, at least one AM station in D.C., one AM station in Baltimore that has news talk programming. They have a syndicator which syndicates the Al Sharpton show, and Al Sharpton interviews many newsmakers and journalists. So they're trying to have it both ways, the way WBLS and WIB had it. But, of course, the difference was WBLS had news. Now, we could criticize the news they had when they became a hot commercial disco medium, but it was still news compared to WIB's now quaint radicalism, you know, in terms of the things that they were allowed to do in WIB. So, again, you see the slow decline. The fact that an inner city could have it both ways, but have it both ways in a way that would satisfy black radicals and black mainstream people, you see Radio One goes a notch below that and makes news and talk programming basically niche programming on their AM stations while having no news on their FM stations. Again, you see the slow decline.
The question becomes, given the history of black ownership in radio, is black ownership as a focus of raising black radio from the dead, is that really the way to go? Do we have any indication that simply getting more black owners into the management position at black radio actually translates into better services to the community?
There is no guarantee. One of the ironies of black radio history is the fact that we know that many black radio stations were owned by white liberals, and they were liberal. They were politically liberal. They were culturally liberal. And so they allowed black radio to develop. I mean, ironically, we owe those white liberals for the development of black radio we are now discussing the decline of. So there's no guarantee that black ownership will mean the reverting to the traditional role of black radio. Now, we would like to think that black people have a conscience. I mean, one of the things that is not discussed dealing with the history of black entertainment television, for instance, is the constant attempt, albeit low budget, but constant attempt to provide news and public affairs programming with the idea that it had to be commercially viable in order to do it. I mean, we've had two examples of black BET newscasts. We've had all sorts of examples in the late 80s and early 90s of news and public affairs programming, but all of them were not commercially viable. So you see the tension within a Bob Johnson and a Sheila Johnson in that they understand the history and development of black radio. They want to transfer some of that to television, but they have to make it commercially viable. So when it's not commercially viable, they cut it off, and then they go, well, we tried. Whereas with black radio history, you had all of that mixed in. All of that was part of the package. But there wasn't this huge demand for shareholder return that we now have to deal with. And that may be the real factor in terms of whether black ownership would matter or not.
With Kiss FM now gone in New York, there's no place for the syndicated shows Tom Joyner and Michael Basden. Should we miss them?
Always a complicated question when we deal with our black syndicated programming. Why? Because we have hosts and producers who understand the history of black radio. And in the case of Joyner, he is part of the history of black radio that we discuss. It's such a mixed bag because these syndicated programs provide a national daily town hall forum for black people and black issues when those hosts and producers decide that that is what it is. But they also provide a lot of distraction, a lot of silly, insubstantive programming. So it's always a mixed bag when we talk about our syndicated programming. Of course, one of the big problems is that this nationally syndicated programming development has destroyed the development of local programming on black radio stations across the country. Now, that gives the assumption that if Tom Joyner and Michael Basden didn't exist, people would create them for the purpose of saving money and developing this local talent. So I don't really know. I mean, it just kind of depends on what day you're listening, what hour you're listening to these folks, whether they're doing something real or not.
What can the FCC do to reverse this trend toward demise?
I think the FCC can hold hearings. I don't really know what they can do as a monitor for a commercial media system. I mean, can they demand that the airwaves have a certain percentage of people of color? I mean, I literally don't know if they can do that. And if they can do that, where do they do that? Being that America is a capitalist society and every wavelength is up for sale. I really don't know. I think that the FCC can bring a spotlight to the issue, and I think they're bringing a spotlight to the issue, hopefully educates and hopefully galvanizes the public and forces people to think in new ways.
It should be the public galvanizing the FCC.
Well, we hope the hearings will galvanize the public. Now, who's going to cover the hearings? That's a very good question, Glenn. I felt the question coming. I don't know. Can this be built up the way black websites and other media build up Trayvon or Gina Six? I mean, I really don't know. Most of us don't own any resources in America, and we don't have wealth, so media ownership is never a strong topic of discussion. What we normally discuss is media portrayal because we think we have some sort of control over that. But I don't know how the future is going to go. I do know that radio will die. And it will die within the next 50 years. And black radio whatever black radio exists will die too in that next 50 years. And that's just the reality of what is now known as terrestrial radio. What replaces radio is another issue. Now, you know, the white left, the white right, they have their forums, they have their networks. You know, they'll continue to move forward. But again, black communication is so dependent on other people. I don't know how we're going to move forward. And I don't know that if we do move forward, whether we'll actually direct that movement.
Well, we do know who won't be covering those hearings. That is black radio commercial news, since it doesn't exist.
And all commercial media won't cover those hearings. So you have a betrayal of the black community by black radio not covering that those hearings. But you also have a betrayal of white commercial corporate media betraying its own audience and its own mandate by not covering those hearings.
Many people see some light at the end of the tunnel in the form of low-power FM. How do you see it?
I think we need to stop talking about lights at the end of the tunnel. I think we need to accept that there's always going to be a tunnel, and whether or not we see lights are up to us. I think that media is going to evolve so rapidly that what we are talking about right now may be irrelevant even 15 years from now. I think that what would be helpful is that we build institutions that teach standards and that reward people for teaching standards, not only journalistic standards, but cultural standards, political standards. And I think we need to fund and reward people who live up to those standards. And I think once we do that and we have generations of people who are determined to live up to those standards, the way the right wing and the left wing are determined to create news media and cultural media and give the people who they train standards and make them hold up to the standards and reward them for doing so. I think that if we can do the same thing, it may not matter that there may not be a black radio or a radio. What may matter is that we still communicate the concerns and the spirituality of our people to our people.
Dr. Todd Burrows of Morgan State University in Baltimore. Nearly 230 years after the end of the American War for Independence, the role of blacks on both sides of the conflict is still a matter of contention. The Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, puts the number of black soldiers that fought with George Washington's forces at about 5,000. But Alan Gilbert, author of the book Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for Emancipation in the War for Independence, says the real figure is considerably higher. We asked Gilbert why large numbers of blacks would fight for the rebels when the British offered freedom and the American Continental Army did not.
My book actually transforms this issue, and here's why. At the Battle of Yorktown, the decisive battle of the Revolution in which the British were defeated, a German private, Georg Daniel Flohr, who fought with the French, Rochambeau, on the side of the Americans, walked around the field of battle afterwards. And he said, most of the corpses lying around the field on both sides, that is, both loyalists and patriots, were Moors, blacks. Now, the way this subject has been discussed is as follows. After the history of this was whited out, so it's the white American Revolution for Independence, black abolitionists in the North and others, abolitionists, celebrated Crispus Attucks as a great martyr of the Revolution and who led the early fighting against British tyranny. But then again, it was whited out in the long racism of Jim Crow. And what happened is that the DAR had a completely white view of the Revolution, and this led to their barring Marian Anderson from singing in 1939 at protests. And so it was a victory for anti-racists if it got noticed that Crispus Attucks and a few others were there. And even so great an historian as Gary Nash writes a book in 2006 about black participation in the Revolution, which is called The Forgotten Fifth. So the way they see it is a kind of identity politics in which blacks make up a fairly small percentage of those who fought. And what happened is that the Times reporter, Neer, asked the DAR historian, who's lowballed the figures all the way through, and he said 5,000, which is conventionally said by American historians, but it's just a figure repeated from the pre-Civil War abolitionist William Mell, and never checked. And 5,000 out of 400,000 doesn't sound very significant. Okay, so go back to what I just said. They were the crucial fighters of Yorktown, the crucial fighters. Yes, many of the commanders of American forces were slaveholders, but two things had happened. One, they couldn't recruit any white people to fight. White people would join the militias for 10 months and then say, see you later. So Washington had to wage his surprise victory at Trenton on Christmas. The British couldn't imagine there'd be a fight on Christmas because he had to give up these forces, you know, shortly thereafter. So in Rhode Island, they weren't getting any troops, and Rhode Island was a leftist state. And in Rhode Island, the governor and one of the generals suggested that they recruit blacks. So they recruited the 1st Rhode Island Regiment, which was entirely made up of blacks and Narragansett Indians. And the total number of people who fought in Rhode Island was probably blacks and Native Americans. It's probably around 657. That's by an independent black historian who has worked very hard on the issue, and my suspicion is that he's basically right about it. This force fought throughout the war. Their freedom was paid for by the state of Rhode Island. Every member of the Rhode Island Regiment was free. In Connecticut, they formed a black regiment. In Boston, they formed a regiment called the Bucks of Massachusetts, which probably fought at Yorktown, and of which there aren't records. So that, except for a couple of indications, a flag given by John Hancock to the regiment and various other things, there aren't a lot of numbers that it's easy to associate with them. So what happened at Yorktown was the following. One of the commanders of the 1st Rhode Island Regiment was a fellow named Olney, Stephen Olney. And when Washington had to get his best troops to take the British redoubt, the two British strongholds, he got the black troops. They were the most experienced fighters, as his aide, Baron von Clausen, said. 25% of the total American forces at Yorktown, 6,000 forces, 1,500 blacks. They were the best under arms, the best in maneuvers, the most cheerful, the most willing to fight. They were fighting for freedom, they thought. And they had the experience. And so they went off to battle. So Olney said, Washington said to them, act the part of brave soldiers. And they fixed bayonets and walked off in silence. And Olney said, I imagined that His Excellency's knee shook, but perhaps it was mine. I thought with the soldiers that with 15 minutes walk, they must think the journey of life will end with them. And then they listened and listened and listened, and shots rang out, and that wasn't good. But the black soldiers carried the day under the leadership of John Lawrence, who was an abolitionist, though a slaveholder. His family was slaveholder. And Alexander Hamilton. So the reason that there's this big fight on the American side, just to spell it out, is this. There's a second revolution, which is in many ways more important than the first. The first revolution is for independence, and that's the one everybody talks about. The second revolution was against slavery and began with 30 slave revolts between 1750 and 1770 in the Caribbean. Everywhere there were uprisings against slavery. And the sailors who had been seized by press gangs, white as well as black, and who identified their condition, you know, you're walking along the street and they come and grab you, and then, you know, climb the mast, and if you fall off, it's your tough luck. Seems like it's pretty close to slavery. They were abolitionists, and these are the people who led a lot of the revolutionary crowds, including the Boston Tea Party. There were also Christian abolitionists started by the Quakers who mostly didn't fight. But all the other Christians, a lot of them came in on this. So Samuel Hopkins said, slavery is a sin of crimson dye, and blamed every defeat of the patriots on their holding slaves. And he said, the only way, in 1775, the only way that we're going to win this revolution against the British recruiting blacks and using them against us is to free all the blacks ourselves. We don't even have to recruit them to fight, we just have to free them. So there was this very large movement from below, which tremendously affected the consciousness of the American Revolution. And the best thing that happened in the Revolution in 1779, the Continental Congress passed a bill saying that Georgia and South Carolina should recruit 2,000 black slaves and freedmen in Georgia and 3,000 in South Carolina in exchange for fighting. And this is called the Lorenz proposal for John Lorenz, who fought for it. He was an aide to George Washington. And Washington went along with it, even though it would have meant gradual emancipation in the South after the Revolution. And it was defeated only by the legislatures in South Carolina and Georgia. The slave owners there would rather submit to the British than mobilize blacks to fight for freedom. They were not freedom fighters.
Isn't there a danger, Mr. Gilbert, in combating the white out of black participation on the independent side in that war, that you're exaggerating the impact of blacks on the independent side? For example, at Yorktown, the best fighters and a quarter of those fighters, as you say, were black, but that represented only 1,500 troops. I've heard estimates in terms of black participation on the Loyalist or British side of 100,000.
Yes, and actually, there are estimates from 20,000, which is the lowball estimate, to 100,000. And I provide serious figures and go over every list. So one of the ways in which I protect myself against exaggeration, is that I do numbers much more than historians do. And what I claim is based on actually going over lists and breaking down statistics, so you can see in the book how I do that. But there's no doubt that the reason this hasn't been discussed on the American side, and even black abolitionists during the run-up to the Civil War didn't discuss it, is that the dirty secret of the American Revolution is that Governor Dunmore of Virginia, starting in 1772, threatened to free all the blacks and indentured servants who would come to the British side, and he said to the rebellious and, he thought, proud slave-owning colonists, "I will free them all if you do this, and I will raise your mansions to the ground." So, naturally, lots of blacks thought that the crown represented freedom. And at the same time, as Dunmore was making these threats, there was a decision in Britain of the British High Court, the Mansfield decision, which freed slaves on British soil, or at least the slave James Somerset, and was interpreted widely and by blacks as freeing slaves on British soil, so that England was no longer seen as a home for bondage. And the slave owners, therefore, rebelled in a parallel to a secession, parallel to the Civil War, that is, in the South. The whole South rebelled to preserve slavery, primarily. Virginia had a few other reasons. South Carolina probably only joined the colonies, the independence movement, to preserve slavery.
And, of course, so, that's where the great majority of black folks were, in those slave colonies that wanted to become states.
Yes and no. Just a qualification. Yes, they were mostly in South Carolina and to a great extent Virginia. But there was many slaves in New York at the time. And New York actually had declared gradual emancipation in 1799, and there's a complicated history. But actually, one of the things I do is look at the American Revolution in the context of independence movements of black and brown people throughout the hemisphere. So Haiti was made independent and created by the slaves of Saint-Domingue who rose up starting in 1791, and they made Haiti in 1804. So independence was abolition. In Venezuela, Bolivar was losing to Spain and went to Republican Haiti and got support in exchange for gradual emancipation. So emancipation and independence went together. They still committed genocide against indigenous people. They weren't wonderful. But if you compare America, North America, to the revolutions to the South of black and brown people, it's utterly startling that in the first new nation, there was gradual emancipation only in the North, and there was a civil war 84 score, et cetera, years later, over the issue of bondage. It's the only place.
And, of course, we are aware of a large black population in New York City. 30% of New York City was black at one time, and New York City experienced slave revolts. But these were still small numbers compared to the great bulk of the black population being in what then came to be known as the slave states. All of the United States were slave states at one point, as you pointed out. But yes. In that same Yorktown, after that battle in which you point out the importance of the 1,500 black soldiers fighting for Washington. We also know that Washington's troops lined up on the shore as the British were leaving and were taking with them, against the wishes of the Americans on the shore, the white Americans, thousands of black soldiers who had fought with the British and their families.
Well, the British did take with them lots of blacks, but not from Yorktown. And they did manage to take some of the black soldiers who had fought for them. But the bulk of blacks who went with the British, there were a huge number who were recruited by the British and did all sorts of work for the British. They did all the building and so on and so forth. They were mistresses of British officers, everything. But they were also soldiers, probably, I don't know the exact number, probably a fifth. And if the British had just recruited the much larger number of blacks, as you say, who came to their side, they would have won, pure and simple. But they didn't, out of racism, largely. So every division had lots of black troops. There were black guerrilla war operations led by Captain Ty in New Jersey and by the Black Dragoons in South Carolina. There were many ways in which black soldiers affected the British Army in North America. They did all the scouting for the British Army and so on, and the scouts also fought. And lots of blacks left, and behind Cornwallis's troops and every other big British military operation, there were thousands of blacks. And in order to get food, because the British hadn't provided for that, they would sack Royalist plantations as well as Patriot or Whig plantations. And the British would steadily recruit more and more of them. So what happened was, unfortunately, the Cornwallis was not a very good guy in any respect. He, in fact, wasn't a very good commander, and he was a rat as a human being. So what he did was drive the blacks between the lines of the Redcoats and the Patriots, with the French behind the Redcoats on the sea, so which is why he couldn't escape. So the result of it was that most of the blacks who'd been following the British had to make their way and try to escape, and a lot of them probably didn't. And it's a very sad story.
You mentioned Colonel Ty from New Jersey, which I found one of the most fascinating stories, period, of the
Amen.
American War of Independence.
Ty was originally named Titus and was a slave to a Quaker, John Corliss, in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. And in 1775, Ty answered the proclamation of Governor Dunmore that I mentioned before. It was actually officially delivered in November 1775, that he would free all blacks and Native Americans and indentured servants who came to the British side and fought the rebels. And he went and fought with Dunmore.
In Virginia?
In Virginia. And Dunmore won the first couple of battles, and half his troops were the Royal Ethiopian Regiment with the slogan, Liberty to Slaves, sewn into their uniforms. But although he was in many ways quite a brilliant strategist, he was not a good military commander. And having won an early battle, he was defeated at the Battle of Great Bridge. Dunmore eventually retreated to New York. And in New York, there was an effort to form guerrilla forces by the Loyalists, not the British High Command. And the Loyalists, among other things, commissioned Ty to lead a guerrilla band in New Jersey. And he recruited a multiracial band, and he killed 10 of the leading and most vicious patriots, that is, the people who cut the throats of the British without a second thought. And he captured 10 others and took them to Sugar House Prison in New York. And he took everybody by surprise, and nobody knew that he was coming. And this went on for 3 years. So it set a pattern for guerrilla war in New Jersey, which was a very big phenomenon, doing all these kinds of things and getting supplies from New York. And as the war went on, a similar thing happened in South Carolina, inspired by the efforts of Tye. Now, finally, there was a battle in which Tye confronted this patriot, Josiah Huddy, who was in the house with Lucretia Emmons, and she was reloading the guns, and he was running to the windows firing. And they eventually captured him, and on the way back, they were surprised, and there was another battle, and he got shot and supposedly got lockjaw from the wound and died. And ironically, probably to make fun of the British, but actually I think out of a genuine sense that Tye was a very special guy, the Patriot papers ran a series of stories about how the brave Captain Tye was killed, that he was the best commander on the British side and a dangerous enemy. He killed probably half of the Patriot elite in Monmouth, New Jersey.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey will return next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.